Well, people ask me who I like to read all the time, and of course I've got about four different books going at any one time. I need to be better about finishing the ones that I start, but nonetheless, folks are often surprised when I say that one of my favorite authors to read is a fellow named Bill Bryson. Bill Bryson is an American author who is an expat now. He lives in England. He lives, I believe, just outside of Cambridge. And he left the United States after college, as so many of us did back in the 70s and 80s and 90s, with maybe railroad passes to go around the world, airplane tickets to backpack around the world and see the world before we began our adult lives. And, well, he ran out of money and worked for a newspaper in England, married an English girl, and has never come back. But nonetheless, he has written any number of wonderful books that I've enjoyed over the years. Of course, A Walk in the Woods is his book about walking the Appalachian Trail, and that was made into a movie with none other than Robert Redford and Nick Nolte about 5 years ago. It's a hilariously funny book. A book that I've invited the seniors or rising seniors to read if they're thinking about a topic for their thesis on Americana is his book, One Summer, the summer of 1927. And he weaves this amazing story, recounting all of the amazing things that happened in the United States that 1 year. So people like Lindbergh flying across the Atlantic and Babe Ruth hitting for the record home run, the Coolidge administration, etc. But his most recent book is entitled At Home, A Short History of Private Life. And it is another of his wonderful reads. One commentator said that it is a comfortable read that you could read in your pajamas and slippers. In fact, he believed that Bryson must have written it in his pajamas. But nonetheless, Bryson walks us through the development of the human home, the domicile, and how it came to be. And there he begins to talk about each individual room. And what caught my mind as I prepared for my homily this morning was his comments about the development of a separate dining room. It seems as though the separate dining room began, according to historians, with the ancient Greeks, who gathered on stone or wood couches, but only the men. The women were supposed to be in the back room, busy with their housework. The Greek men gathered together in their private room to eat honey cakes and chestnuts all by themselves. Now, the ancient Romans developed in their villas a separate room called the triclinium, that some of our students have done in their reports in elementary grammar school. And ladies were invited to the triclinium to join the family meal. By the Middle Ages, wealthier people were eating in dining rooms, but they were still not very comfortable places at all. Dogs running around under your feet, the hearth was a new invention, more likely an open fire in the middle of the room there to drive out the drafts. But of course, everyone smelled like a campfire after dinner was over. But as the Industrial Revolution displaced the Middle Ages, this brought with it increased prosperity, and many people were able to enjoy the benefits of a special room for formal dining. Although Bryson is quick to say that, as a matter of fact, the modern dining room was really developed not as a place to eat in, but it was a place to keep your best furniture and your best plates. It was really more a place to get all of your nicest stuff away from the kids and the servants, who are likely to drop your best plates and break them or wipe their greasy hands all over your nice upholstery. So the dining room, you just kept all your nice stuff in. But finally, Bryson, in his book At Home, talks about how it was that the dining room became the place in which the wealthy could go and enjoy the best furniture, the best china, and their linen tablecloths to eat their meals in. Thomas Jefferson, Bryson said, stunned the American public when he included a dining room at Monticello because of the fact that everyone else was simply eating on saw tables there in their common rooms in amongst all the detritus of the colonial home. So Jefferson put his home above all the rest just by including a dining room. We all know that dining rooms can be tricky places. All of these extras, right? I mean, we can, like I did yesterday, eat on your lap with French fries, burgers without any help from even plastic forks and paper napkins. And then what happens when you get thrown into your grandmother's formal dining room where you're expected to be able to navigate the linen napkin? Where is that supposed to go? Where do I put my hands after all? On the table? In my lap? Good posture. Don't slouch. Not eating with your hands, of course, not smacking, scratching, or picking your teeth. Yes, all of these extra rules that we never use anywhere else. And finally, where do I sit exactly? I mean, whose job is it to tell me where to sit? And we feel the burden of that, say at dinner clubs, when you go over to someone else's house and you're wondering, do I sit down now? Or do they tell me where to sit? And there we find ourselves right in the midst of our gospel lesson today. Jesus tells a parable about a dinner party in which the guests are arguing with one another about where they should sit. Now, from the outset, perhaps we are puzzled just at the fact that this even makes the cut for the gospel account. I mean, shouldn't Luke and shouldn't Jesus, the object of Luke's gospel, be more interested in really important things like how to get saved, for instance? That seems to be like the top of most Christians' list. How do I get saved? How do I find a loving God? How do I achieve forgiveness? What am I supposed to make of this parable that seems to be really more out of Emily Post's book on etiquette than it is about how I achieve eternal salvation? Shouldn't Jesus and Luke be more interested in questions about works or grace, or perhaps what am I supposed to do with rules regarding sacraments, or perhaps even whether I should fast? All of these really critical Christian questions, and Luke is wandering on about who gets to sit where at meals. And it's not simply here, but throughout the whole of the Gospel of Luke, he seems preoccupied with this idea of eating. Luke's Gospel has more meals in it than any other Gospel, and certainly any other book in the New Testament. That should make us wonder why. Jesus says that he was telling the audience a parable. So that should tip us off to what's going on here after all. This parable is about a wealthy man who threw a wedding for his son, and he invited many to come in and sit down. And when they did, they began to argue about who was more honorable or more glorious, and so who deserved to sit closer to the host of the party and the guest of honor being the son and, of course, his newly wed wife. Who is more important? Who gets to sit towards the top of the table and who has to sit out in the cloakroom, maybe eating off of the paper plates? That's really the heart of this parable, this question of glory or honor or reputation. You see, Jesus seemed to have a very great disregard in all of his ministry about people's reputations. He went marching around with big work boots, knocking over all kinds of social hierarchies, embarrassing people in their own homes, expecting people to receive the unreceivable, to enjoy the company of the marginalized, to, in fact, throw out all social tradition and instead put themselves in a position to receive this new kingdom that Jesus kept talking about, but they wondered exactly what it could possibly mean. And here, Jesus is doing exactly that. The tradition was, of course, that the important or leaders of the community would always expect to be able to sit in the places of honor. This reached back to the way the people of Israel thought of themselves as being the honored people of the world. God had called the Hebrews, not the Philistines. He had called the Israelites, not the Egyptians. They had been given the position of honor from the very beginning. So wouldn't it stand to reason then that those who were more holy in the people of Israel received the places of honor over their perhaps less devoted neighbors? Being first in God's kingdom had everything to do with making sure that you were given the honors due to one's holy status. And we as Americans struggle to understand passages like this almost entirely. Americans are devoted to the idea, we might call it the law of meritocracy. We threw off a king, didn't we? In fact, our forebears lopped a king's head off in the mid-1600s, just as the colonists were heading to this new country. So we were pretty clear that that whole kind of peerage was a pretty meaningless, fatuous kind of habit that needed to be thrown out the window. So we as Americans think that we're happy to go jostle around with our neighbors without any kind of due what kind of respect. In fact, respect has pretty well gone out the window as well. The only thing that Americans really respect is either being really good at your job, especially if it has something to do with science or medicine, because that having our attention when our health fails. So what we need is a really good doctor, and we also need a really good attorney. Two moments in our lives where we need high-functioning professionals. And nothing speaks to Americans like money, right? So when it comes to respect, the people who have the most money get the most respect. And so passages like this one that depend on our ability to at least appreciate the fact that the honor that these men that Jesus was criticizing depended upon their supposed holy status, that they got the positions of honor over the lower levels or echelons of the Jewish community, seemed to us to be a useless passage. But Jesus wants us to consider deeply how it is that the leaders of Israel were leading the children of Israel, the Jews of Jesus' day, away from the Lord their God. Being a teacher of the law was an honorable profession. They were supposed to not only study God's law, but also keep God's law. But being a better rabbi, being a better teacher, while it got you in a more prominent seat, finally led the rabbis of Jesus' day to be critical and finally dismissive of those who they were sent to guide and to lead. The ones who got the bad seats, after all, were the ones who were day laborers. And that was the vast majority of Jews in Jesus' day. It was a poor country, oppressed and occupied by foreign power. And most of the Jews of Jesus' day were just trying to keep from starving to death. They didn't have time to study God's law. They were out trying to bust rocks and grow a little bit of a garden on the side to keep themselves from starving to death. And they, of course, could not sit in the synagogues day in and day out studying God's law. And so they got the lower seats in the kingdom. They got the lower seats in the synagogues, while the rabbis got the higher or upper seats. But not only lower people in the Jewish community, but as Luke pens his gospel towards the end of the first century AD, it was Gentiles now who were coming into God's kingdom by the thousands, if we understand that the Acts of the Apostles to be in any way accurate. That the Gentiles, now hearing the good news of Israel's Messiah, Jesus Himself, they believe, are baptized, and come into God's kingdom by the thousands. But if a poor Jew would get a bad seat in a synagogue, what kind of seat would a newly converted Gentile get? Would he be like by the door with the baggage? Or would he be outside holding the carts and the horses outside? Who gets the highest seat, the position of honor in God's kingdom when it comes? Jesus is asking his audience. This is a parable. Who gets honor in God's kingdom when it comes? Would it be the rabbis who had demanded boundary? Or would it be those weak and poor and brokenhearted, the ones whom Jesus said that he had come to find? You see, Jesus' idea about God's kingdom was turning the world upside down. Those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. In God's kingdom, those who seek and serve the poor and the broken, the weakest in the community, they are the ones that deserve to have the highest seat in God's kingdom. You see, glory, that is honor and respect, glory is about seeking God's kingdom first. Glory is a churchy word, I know. Whenever I teach theology classes, I ask the kids to try to think about new ways of describing an idea. We've got words like grace and salvation, and glory is one of those things that we never use those words anywhere else in our conversation except in church. And so we just kind of assume that everybody else knows what we mean. And we try to do better than that here at New Covenant. But glory is one of those churchy words. Humpty Dumpty said to Alice, when she asked him what he meant by glory, Humpty Dumpty said to her, glory is having a nice knockdown argument, which means being able to defeat somebody in a debate, right? Is that what you think of when you use the word glory, that you can defeat somebody in an argument? Probably not. But seeking glory is a common human desire. It's not a sinful thing to seek to be good and to be recognized for being good. I'm puzzled today about the way that people that between the ages of, say, 10 and 30, really, I guess, but at least 10 and 20, seek glory by having the most likes on their YouTube page. I don't get that at all. Kids today seek to become these multi-million dollar social influencers, which is the weirdest thing to me. They're not producing any goods or services, but instead that I hear from our kids here even, but certainly read about it on the internet, that this culture coming up, the iGen, one of their highest aspirations is become a cultural influencer by having millions of people watching them do things like brush their teeth on their YouTube page. This is insane. But having said it, I simply point to this central idea that human beings seek their glory, but are they seeking God's glory? The master of this wedding feast in Jesus' parable says to the one who is lowly, "Friend, go up higher." You see, our place in God's wedding feast comes from Him by His grace alone, His love of us alone, for Jesus' sake alone. While we didn't get a chance to read the next few verses from Luke's Gospel, I will spoil it for you and tell you that it's about another banquet. Luke's got eating on his mind here. And it's about the king who calls a wedding banquet for his son and all of the people who refuse to come. And we hear that gospel lesson many, many times throughout the church year according to the lectionary. But it is worth mentioning as it relates to our gospel lesson today. The next verses are about a party, a banquet that nobody would come to until the king sent out his police force to get all the poor people, all the sick people, and all the broken people, and forced them at the point of a sword or a spear to come to his party because he wanted them to be there. And all the people who refused get thrown out. I went to visit one of the members of the parish, which is one of my favorite things to do in the whole wide world this week. And, I went to see the Spivas. And we sat out on the back porch and drank beer and watched the sunset go down over that pond or lake behind their house. And it's the most wonderful way to spend an evening here in Virginia. And Jace surprised me by asking me a really blunt question, which is, how do people become Episcopalians? And it's kind of like, you know, asking, you know, what does the Easter Bunny do? Come by and bop people on the head or something like that. How do people become Episcopalians? And that is a good question. I'd like to have about 1,000 more of them sitting right crammed into this space right here. I want this parish to be successful, but I want to answer that question by asking another one, which is, how do people become Christians after all, whether they be Episcopalian or not? This parable demands that we grapple with that question. What is our mission to the world that God loves so much? The parable is about who gets to sit in God's dining room, who gets to eat at God's table. And we so often, and it's not, I'm not accusing you of anything, but we so often think about it as being, well, the people that are in God's dining room are the ones that should be there. If they should be there, then they'll get there. But of course, that's completely wrong-headed and upside down. Our mission, you see, must be to the world around us that is hungry. And I don't mean just in their tummies, but they're hungry for the eternal. Who are the weak? Who are the lost? Who are the poor? Who are the suffering? Not in Africa or Southeast Asia, but who are they in Lynchburg? Who are the broken people in Lynchburg? Who are the ones that Jesus loves dearly, that he was willing to die for them? They are the ones that we're supposed to be inviting to the table. And if we say, well, we got a good seat, of course, the response is, well, brother, you should go down a few places because I've reserved this seat that you're holding for someone else, a lower brother or sister. These parables that Jesus tells drive us to this conclusion that the world is a starving place, not in their bellies, although we do need to feed the poor and the hungry. But the world is a dark and broken place because of the power of sin and death. And Jesus came to save it and has left us in his power to continue to do that very thing. Our mission, you see, is to go out and proclaim the party, the banquet. The seats are available. We should go find them and bring them in. Amen.